Chapter 2. External Supporter. Description, Background. Any understanding of Iran's relationship with Hezbollah must account for the dramatic reinterpretation of the Shia faith that occurred in Iran in the two decades leading up to the 1979 revolution. This reinterpretation was an outgrowth of the crisis of legitimacy of the Pahlavi monarchy, combined with the profound socioeconomic changes and dislocations brought about through the early and mid-20th century modernization efforts initiated by Reza Shah and his son, Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi. Iran in 1900 was described by one observer as a fairly primitive, almost isolated state, barely distinguishable as an economic entity. About one-fifth of the population of about 10 million lived in small towns. Another quarter consisted of nomadic tribes, while the rest eked out an existence in poor villages. Agriculture was the primary occupation, and the almost complete lack of roads, railways, or other transport facilities made it essential for each geographic region to be self-sufficient in foodstuffs. Industrial activity was sparse, with no serious attempts having been made to explore or exploit a potentially vast array of natural resources. Another observer noted, families were large, women had no rights, men could have as many as four wives, and male children were strongly preferred. In order to keep the peasants ignorant and poor, the landowners opposed the establishment of schools or clinics. More than 95% of the population was illiterate, and education largely entailed mullahs instructing boys in reading and writing, calligraphy, Arabic grammar, and the memorization of Quranic passages, verses of poetry, and Shia catechism. Additionally, land ownership was highly skewed, with 1% of the population owning 56% of the land in the early 1960s. Such underdevelopment posed a threat to Iran's independent existence, as it translated to a lack of capacity and power resources to withstand Russian and British domination. Similar to Meiji Japan in the mid-19th century and Turkey under Ataturk, Iran found that it was imperative to modernize, lest it face a future of vassalage to outside powers. Indeed, the comparison with Turkey is perhaps more apt, as both countries had to deal with elements opposed to modernization in the form of traditionalist landowners and a religious establishment hostile to secularism. Hence, after Reza Khan's successful coup deposing the decrepit Qajar dynasty in 1921 and his accession to the throne as Reza Shah in 1925, the new king commenced a modernization program that was continued by his son. Over time, this effort generated the seeds of the monarchy's destruction, as it led to the disenchantment of the religious class and the establishment of a middle class and intelligentsia frustrated with the centralization of power under the monarchy. Various reforms proposed by the new king promoted the expansion of the secular state into matters hitherto monopolized by the clerical establishment. Reforms in education, law, and the status of women represented an encroachment of a modernizing state into society and formed the basis for state-society tensions. In education, Reza Shah established a state education system featuring 6 years each for elementary and secondary instruction based on a modern curriculum, a policy that diminished the authority of the religious establishment, which had previously maintained a monopoly on educational instruction. Additionally, in 1932, secularization was introduced into the judiciary when a law was enacted that required the registration of documents and property to be handled solely by secular courts, as opposed to Sharia courts. Religious officials who had previously derived a significant portion of their income administering these activities suffered a further blow in 1936 when new legislation required that judges hold a degree from either the Tehran Faculty of Law or a foreign university. Both reforms led many religious officials to abandon the judiciary. Another key reform effort involved the uplift of women. The educational reforms mentioned involved the compulsory education of girls as well as boys, and in 1934, women were admitted to the law school and school of medicine in Tehran. The February 1936 law that restricted women's use of the all-encompassing and funereal chador was particularly noteworthy. In 1928, demonstrations broke out in Tabriz against the unveiling of women. Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi continued his father's modernization drive with his so-called White Revolution, his government's signature effort to modernize Iran's social and economic systems. The establishment of universal, and in particular female, suffrage was one component of this effort, as was land reform. Reza Shah's effort at land reform, the 1937 Land Development Act, which sought to encourage the optimum use of land by both landlords and peasants, failed because its implementation was left to landlords. In the early 1960s, his son enacted legislation to reduce the size of large estates. Given that many members of the legislature were large landowners, to achieve land reform, he found it necessary to dissolve the legislative branch for a period of time and rule by decree. The six-point reform program, the main policy initiative of the White Revolution, approved in a national referendum in January 1963, promoted land reform. Land reform also drew the resistance of the ulama, as many mullahs themselves were also large landowners, especially in the provinces of Azerbaijan, Kerman, and Isfahan. In February 1960, Ayatollah Burujerdi, the leading mujtahid, jurisprudent at the time, issued a statement indicating that any effort to limit the size of landed estates was contrary to Islam. Such reforms contributed to a crisis of state legitimacy that was further compounded by Mohammad Reza's foreign policy and, in particular, his pro-Israel and pro-U.S. orientation, especially his acquiescence to the instrumental use of Iran as a frontline state against the expansion of Soviet influence in the Persian Gulf and Middle East. The latter implied inclusion within the American orbit and a measure of subservience to the interests of the United States, which the clergy saw as inimical to the national religious identity of the country. The modernization drive under the Pahlavis led to the mobilization of the religious establishment. In January 1963, the ulama organized a violent demonstration to obstruct the national referendum on the six-point reform program. This demonstration was followed up in March 1963 by violent clashes between the Shah's secret police and oppositional clerics and religious students. And on the 10th day of Muharram, June 2nd, which commemorates the martyrdom of Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad, Ayatollah Ruhollah Khomeini was arrested after giving an inflammatory sermon in which he labeled the Shah as the living Yazid of our time. The arrest of Khomeini and his followers led to clashes in Tehran, and resentment against the Shah grew considerably in Qom and other important religious cities, such as Mashhad and Yazd. The clergy's grievances concerning the modernization and secularization of society under the Shah and their reduced social and economic status within the new order combined with those of liberals and Marxists opposed to the concentration of state power under the monarchy, leading to the establishment of a somewhat uneasy clerical-secular opposition to Mohammad Reza. Leading thinkers from both of these camps, with members of the liberal and Marxist intelligentsia either educated abroad in Europe or America, or espousing foreign ideas, contributed to a combustible intellectual milieu characterized by Marxist-populist anti-colonial themes and the cross-fertilization and hybridization of ideas. This intellectual ferment led to the reinterpretation of Shia doctrine and contributed, after more than a millennium of quietism, to the emergence of revolutionary Shiism. One such thinker was Ahmad Fardid, a leading scholar of German philosophy, and in particular the work of Martin Heidegger. Fardid coined the highly influential term Garbzadegi, or Weststruckness, meaning a state of infliction by a corruptible force identified as Garb, or West. Fardid saw Iranian national culture as an organic entity, with westernization impairing rational disposition and depriving Iranians of natural, moral, and authentic existence. The notion of Garbzadegi was picked up by Jalal Al-Amad, who made it the title of a 1962 book. Al-Amad saw westernization as obliterating authentic existence, and the key aspects of Western modernization, such as urbanization, industrialization, and female liberation, as examples of the exploitative nature of Western modernity that deprived countries in the Third World of their native culture. Most importantly, Al-Amad saw religion as a force of cultural renewal, capable of liberating Iranians from their mental and material dependence on the West. Al-Ahmad's ideas contributed to the notion of dynamic Shi'ism, as he advocated a revolutionary role for members of the clerical establishment who, in conjunction with non-Westernized intellectuals, were called on to resist colonialism and Westernization. Rahimi noted that Al-Ahmad's ideas provided the inspiration for his religious readers, such as Khomeini, to reinterpret Shia ideas, such as martyrdom and justice, in terms of a nativist and anti-colonialist discourse. Another key intellectual at this time was Dr. Ali Shariati, an Iranian sociologist educated at the University of Mashhad. Shariati completed his graduate studies at the Sorbonne in Paris in 1963, where he studied the works of Jean-Paul Sartre and other existentialist thinkers and participated in anti-colonial circles during the Algerian struggle against metropolitan France. Rahimi noted that, quote, while Al-Ahmad was keen on consciousness-raising about the effects of Weststruckness, Shariati was eager to bring about a new consciousness transformation of a revolutionary type that would develop out of a new understanding of Shi'ism, close quotes, and specifically one that was inherently anti-establishment. More specifically, he contrasted the institutionalized quietist version of Shi'ism, which he labeled Safavid Shi'ism, with Alid Shi'ism, a dynamic variant that he argued represented the original spirit of Islam and called on believers to take positive action to fight injustice on earth. Through an exegesis that distinguished jihad from shahadat, or martyrdom, Shariati was perhaps the one most responsible for engendering a cultic devotion to martyrdom and an interest in its instrumental use among Iran's revolutionary generation of leaders. In a speech titled Jihad and Shahadat, Shariati noted that a shahid is one who, quote, negates his whole existence, close quote, for a sacred ideal. The canonical example is provided by the martyrdom of Hussein, who, quote, consciously welcomed death, close quote, by choosing to fight the forces of Yazid, the Umayyad caliph, whom Hussein regarded as an illegitimate ruler. Shariati argued that Hussein chose to engage in battle knowing it would lead to his demise, quote, so that the consequences of his act might be widely spread and the cause for which he gives his life might be realized sooner. Hussein chooses shahadat as an end or as a means for the affirmation of what is being negated and mutilated by the political apparatus, close quote. It is noteworthy that a shahid chooses self-obliteration not only because of the propagandist value of the deed itself, but also because it represents a choice of death over dishonor. In contrast, a mujahid, in other words a person engaged in jihad, is a sincere warrior who may die in the line of fire as an unintended outcome of fighting for his or her faith, but who does not consciously choose shahadat. Thus, quote, shahadat is an invitation to all generations, in all ages, if you cannot kill your oppressor, then die, close quote. Shariati called on Muslims to resist the corruption of society through shahadat by seeking the red death of martyrs rather than dying the black death of cowards. Indeed, Shariati's ideas were influential among Iran's revolutionary leaders, who believed that the true tenets of Islam required the Shia to abandon the quietist tradition that had dominated Shi'ism for more than 1,000 years in favor of a more activist interpretation that sought to reverse the years of misfortune and subjugation suffered by Shia. For instance, Hujjat al-Islam Muhammad Mohammadi Reshari, the first Minister of Intelligence for the Islamic Republic, once criticized conservative or court ulama for tampering with, quote, the hadith found in the books of both the Shias and the Sunnis, close quote, in order to, quote, invite Muslims into submission and quiescence towards oppressive and tyrannical rulers, close quote. He also stated, the Quran invites people to rise up against despotic governments and oppressive rulers. The hadith we attained from the great scholars of Islam call on Muslims to renounce submission and indifference in the face of the ruler's injustices and to rise up in revolt for the institution of equality and justice. He further noted that the court ulama of the past had rendered service to oppressive rulers by concealing the inherently liberating nature of Islam, and so stupefied the minds of the faithful as to facilitate the oppressive rule of tyrannical regimes throughout the Ummah, Islamic community. In a February 1980 sermon given during a khutbah, or Friday congregational prayer, Hojat al-Islam Sayyid al-Khamenei, later to become supreme leader of Iran, noted that the 1979 revolution had shown that Islam is, quote, a religion and a doctrine capable of awakening 36 million people from their centuries of sleep under oppression, close quote, and of humiliating the enemy. Additionally, in an October 1979 sermon, he corrected his audience on the correct meaning of the Arabic word sabr, patience or self-possession, which is mentioned in Quranic verse 103:3, quote, enjoin on each other sabr, close quote. He cautioned that those unfamiliar with Arabic might be forgiven for thinking that sabr might justify quietism by signifying the following. Sit down in the corner and be indifferent to all events, difficulties, and issues. Even if they inflict a blow on your head, don't say ouch. Be patient. Sabr kun. They plundered your possessions. They squandered your resources, wealth, and culture. Sit down. Be patient. God willing, the hidden imam will arrive and rectify everything. Be patient, sir. Be patient. Rather, Khamenei informed his listeners that sabr means to be constantly in a position of struggle, facing hardships and afflictions, and never giving respite to the enemy. Specifically, it denotes struggle and jihad against imperialism and global Zionism. Furthermore, Khamenei noted that only Islam is capable of motivating people to struggle, to jihad, to martyrdom, shahadat, while other philosophies leave them blind and deaf, without a will, fatalistic and submissive.
For Iran's radical generation of clerics, the revolutionary potential of Islam compared favorably with that of various Western ideologies. In Friday's sermons in September 1981, Hojat
al-Islam Ali Akbar Hashemi Rafsanjani, a one-time president of Iran and member of the Assembly of Experts of the Islamic Republic, criticized the school of thought of Marx and Lenin for viewing Islam and religion in general as an opiate that kept the masses subdued. For Rafsanjani, the Islamic Revolution of 1979 revealed the falsity of such charges because it demonstrated that religion was, quote, the greatest stimulant of the masses, close quote, and that Islam was the most effective ideology of revolution. In 1988, Khamenei noted that, as opposed to materialistic ideologies such as communism and capitalism, that view individual will as determined and thus not autonomous, Islam teaches that human beings possess free will and are autonomous with respect to their social action and choices. To support this revolutionary conception of Shia Islam, prayer leaders often cited Quranic verse 13:11. Quote, surely Allah does not change the condition of a people until they change their own condition, close quote. And based on it, Rafsanjani, in a February 1982 sermon, argued that humanity is not a deterministic movement, but rather a voluntary movement that should be initiated by society, by the people themselves. Thus, according to this interpretation of Islam, the basis of revolution and the condition for the progression of a revolution is man. Another key concept is that of intizar, or the messianic expectation of the return of the hidden imam. And Ram noted that the exportation of the Islamic Revolution is deeply rooted in a dynamic reinterpretation of this concept first articulated by Shariati in the late 1960s. Given failures by the Shia to regain what they regarded as their usurped and rightful leadership of the Islamic community, a passive notion of intizar emerged in 873 to 874 AD concerning the occultation of the 12th Imam. This conception called on the Shia to patiently wait for the return of the hidden imam, conceived as the Messiah, Mahdi, who would appear at the end of time, without taking any actions to change their state of existence. Shariati rejected this passive conception of intizar, somewhat similar to Christian Zionists who support the modern state of Israel in the belief that doing so will hasten the second coming of Jesus. Shariati conceived of a greater role for human agency in effectuating divine prophecy, arguing that true intizar required Muslims to take positive actions to encourage the return of the hidden imam from occultation and thereby bring forward the time of their final and eternal salvation. While the elimination of injustice and oppression could occur only with the return of the imam,
In the meantime, the faithful can lay the conditions for the Imam's revolution not with, quote, prayers, but with a banner and a sword, with true holy war involving all responsible believers, close quote. For Shariati, human intervention in the form of revolutionary action to eliminate oppression and promote universal justice was actually necessary to create favorable conditions for the return of the Mahdi, because the hidden Imam would otherwise not return. For Iran's revolutionary leaders, particularly in the immediate period after the revolution, when the establishment and link with Hezbollah was effected, such action was not to be limited to Iran. As noted by Khamenei in June 1980, setting the conditions for the return of the Mahdi required the following steps. First, on the elimination and eradication of the roots of injustice and overflowing tyranny, Togian, I mean in the society of the Vali Yasar, the Lord of the Time, the Hidden Imam, there should be no oppression and injustice, not only in Iran, in the entire world. There should be no economic oppression, no political oppression, no cultural oppression, not any kind of oppression, exploitation, inequality, unreasonable demands, and hooliganism must be eradicated. Khamenei also noted in June 1980 the important world historical role played by the Iranian people in launching a revolution that in turn would hasten the return of the Mahdi. We, the nation of Iran, have made a revolution. Our revolution was the necessary prelude and the great step in the path of that goal which the Imam of the age, Imam Izaman, was sent to accomplish. If we had not taken this great step, surely the appearance of the Vali Yasar would be postponed. You, the people of Iran, are the cause of the advancement of the great human movement towards its destination in history, and the cause of hastening, Tasri, the appearance of the Vali Yasar. Yet the Islamic Revolution was only the first step, quote, a drop of water in the vast ofcean of the Mahdi, close quote, noted Rafsanjani. It was Iran's manifest destiny, noted Khamenei in a Friday congregational sermon in March 1980, to pursue dynamic intizar to the four corners of the earth. We must strive to export our revolution throughout the world. The Quran is not confined to the town of Mecca. It is not limited to the Quraysh infidels. The Quran is not satisfied with guiding the people of one town or one country to happiness and salvation. It is for the inhabitants of the world, Alameen, for all people and for all mankind. The message of Islam must hasten to deliver the people wherever there is poverty, wherever there is discrimination, wherever there is oppression. Another key intellectual and theological cornerstone of the Islamic Revolution, and one that played a critical role in the relationship between Hezbollah and Iran, is Velayat e-Faqih, or the governorship of the jurisprudent. Although this concept is most often associated with Khomeini, particularly because he authored a publication in 1971 of the same title, it was Hussein Ali Montazeri who first made the most extended defense of this concept with the 1964 publication of a four-volume work in Arabic titled Legal Foundations of the Islamic Government. In this work, Montazeri justified the temporal rule of the most senior Shia cleric, who, as the most legitimate representative of the Mahdi, possessed the requisite legitimacy and qualifications to wield spiritual and political authority during the era of occultation. Any other form of government was bound to be either corrupt or tyrannical. The Quranic verse on which Velayat e-Faqih is based is the so-called authority verse, Quran 4:59. Quote, obey God, His Prophet, and those who command authority, close quote. Shia catechism instructs that the Prophet and the 12 Imams are infallible and capable of revealing divine truth, and therefore have the right to guide humanity, which is structurally fallible and lacks the intellectual and moral capacity to understand the esoteric meaning of the Quran, the Prophet's Sunnah, traditions, or the traditions of the Imams. Hence, during the period of occultation, the mujtahids, by virtue of their religious training and knowledge, should assume the responsibility of guiding fallible humanity. Traditionally, the Shia regarded the clerical assumption of political authority as theologically problematic, because the establishment of the Islamic order can occur only with the return of the hidden Imam. Such thinking was the basis for quietism,
And indeed, in the 1950s, Khomeini ascribed to the teachings of Ayatollah Burujerdi, the leading mujtahid at the time, who rejected clerical involvement in politics. In the 1940s book, Kashf al-Ashrar, Revealing of the Secrets, he stated, quote, "We do not claim that the government, hukumat, should be in the hands of the theologian, faqih," close quote, "but that the government should act, quote, according to divine law," close quote. Therefore, clerics should have nazarat, supervision, of the legislative and the executive branches of the Islamic State. Additionally, as late as April 1964, Khomeini stated, "We say the government should stay, but it should respect the laws of Islam, or at least the Constitution." Yet by the late 1960s and early 1970s, Khomeini's view of the relationship between religious and political authority began to change. In his 1971 work, Veliyat-e Faqih, Khomeini denounced nationalism as an imperialist conspiracy meant to divide Muslims. More specifically, he argued that after World War I, imperialist powers imposed unfavorable structural change by dividing the Islamic homeland into peoples and petty states, and placed stooges in these territories to safeguard their political and economic interests. For Khomeini, it was imperative that Muslims unite under the banner of Islam to resist imperialism and Zionism. Who should lead the Ummah against the rapacious and conniving West? Khomeini's theory of Veliyat-e Faqih argued that the imam's right to rule devolved onto religious jurists, and that if one of them succeeded in establishing a government, the other jurists were required to follow him. More specifically, society should be ruled by the most knowledgeable and morally upright mujtahid. This individual, Khomeini conceded, does not possess a personal covenant with Allah, as do the Prophet and the Imams, nor does he possess the Imam's personal infallibility. However, Khomeini bestowed functional veliyat on the jurisconsult, which signified that the jurisconsult has sacred knowledge to determine the hidden meaning of the Quran and therefore participate in the final revelation of the Word of God. In pledging allegiance to Khomeini upon its founding, Hezbollah ascribed to this conception of Veliyat-e Faqih. Indeed, Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah has stated that, quote, "The decision of peace and war is in the hands of the jurisconsult, not in the hands of the intellectuals, researchers, scientists, and regular politicians," close quote. Additionally, he stated, quote, "Where is the force in us? What is Hezbollah's secret? The power is in the obedience to Khomeini's veliyat. The secret of our strength, growth, unity, struggle, and martyrdom is Veliyat-e Faqih, the spinal cord of Hezbollah," close quote. Strategic goals and interest in resistance movement. Iranian foreign policy as it relates to Hezbollah can be seen both from a broad perspective involving timeless, transcendent, and at times noble concerns related to geography, geopolitics, Islamism, and the concern for the weak and powerless, and from a narrow base perspective involving realpolitik, power projection, and regime security. Regarding the former, and in particular geopolitics, Iran's resource endowment and strategic location have conspired to ensure that the country draws the attention of major international and extra-regional powers. For instance, in 1920, Soviet troops entered Iran and sponsored the Communist Republic of Gilan in northern Iran, although Moscow withdrew its troops after Reza Khan's February 1921 coup. Additionally, the British had acquired control of the oil-rich province of Khuzestan, although Reza Shah eventually reimposed central control over the region. During World War II, the country was invaded in August 1941 by both Britain and the Soviet Union and subsequently occupied, as it was feared that Iran's policy of neutrality would prevent the supply of much-needed war material to the USSR after Hitler's invasion of the Soviet Union. More specifically, the British and Russians were interested in securing the Trans-Iranian Railway, which linked the Caspian port of Bandar Shah with the Persian Gulf port of Bandar Shapur and represented the most effective means of transporting U.S. supplies to the Soviet Union. However,
The history of British and Soviet domination of the country prevented Reza Shah from giving these two powers the extraterritorial control they sought over the railway. To preserve the dynasty, Reza Shah abdicated and was exiled to South Africa. Fears of external domination persisted after the end of the war. The country's resource endowment had previously drawn the interest of the Anglo-Iranian Oil Company, and concerns over excessive foreign control of the oil sector resulted in demands, led by parliamentarian and later Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, for the nationalization of the oil sector, which was accomplished in March 1951. Unwilling to accept this setback, the British teamed up with the U.S. Central Intelligence Agency to unseat Mossadegh in a 1953 coup, as the United States was concerned that Mossadegh's brand of populism and cooperation with the communist Tuda Masses Party would open the door to Soviet influence in the country, perhaps even a communist takeover. Fears of outside domination and the blocking of Iran's external ambitions by foreign powers were major concerns, regardless of who was in power in Tehran. Mohammad Reza Shah Pahlavi, the main beneficiary of the 1953 coup, believed that by virtue of being an old and territorially established civilization, Iran should exert influence beyond its borders, particularly within the Persian Gulf region. Yet the Pahlavis were also concerned that outside powers would conspire to prevent Iran from assuming its natural role. Similar geopolitically based fears surrounding sovereignty and national greatness motivated the Islamic revolutionaries who took power in 1979, as they feared that outside satanic powers were trying to destroy Iran's unique revolution. Indeed, concern with sovereignty and independence was reflected in one of the main battle cries of the revolutionaries in 1978-1979, Azadi Esteklal, Jamhuri Islami, Freedom, Independence, Islamic Republic. Lord Palmerston's observation that nations have no permanent friends or allies, only permanent interests, was illustrated by Iran's long-standing concern with sovereignty, exceptionalism, and regional influence, regardless of the nature of the regime in Tehran. These interests caused Iran to turn from friendliness toward the West and Israel under the Shah to violent hostility after the Islamic Revolution in 1979. From this perspective, Iran's sponsorship of Hezbollah reflects a persistent theme in Iranian foreign policy, as it provides the country with an asymmetric strategic deterrent against hostile regional, Israel, and extra-regional, United States, powers, representing, from the Iranian perspective, a Western and colonial implant, Israel, and an interloper and interventionist, the United States, both seeking to limit Iranian power and ambitions in the Middle East. Such a deterrent assumes greater importance when one considers that Iran still lacks a nuclear deterrent against the large, sophisticated nuclear arsenals of the United States and Israel, and that Iran's conventional capabilities are no match for those that American forces can bring to bear in the Gulf region. Iran's support for Hezbollah is also motivated by sentimental factors related to Islamic ecumenism and the spread of Islam, along with a socially constructed conception of Iran's role as the defender of the world's downtrodden and oppressed. Regarding the former, in the last section it was noted how a dynamic notion of Entezar was fostered by Iran's revolutionary generation, which called for the spreading of the revolution to other lands to pave the way for the return of the Mahdi. After the revolution, there were numerous statements by top Iranian officials regarding the need to export the revolution, particularly to the Muslim world, as a way of fostering Islamic universalism. Indeed, this notion was given a constitutional mandate through Article 11 of the Islamic Republic's Constitution, which states, "In accordance with the sacred verse of the Quran, this, your community, is a single community, and I am your Lord, so worship me." 2192. All Muslims form a single nation, and the government of the Islamic Republic has the duty of formulating its general policies with a view to merging and union of all Muslim peoples, and it must constantly strive to bring about the political, economic, and cultural unity of the Islamic world. Additionally, Article 3 notes that the Islamic Republic has the responsibility to seek the, quote, expansion and strengthening of Islamic brotherhood and public cooperation among all the people, close quote, and to frame, quote, the foreign policy of the country on the basis of Islamic criteria, fraternal commitment to all Muslims, and unsparing support to the Mustadafeen, oppressed of the world, close quote. The Constitution also directly addresses the role to be played by the IRGC. Article 150 states, "The Islamic Revolutionary Guards Corps, organized in the early days of the triumph of the revolution, is to be maintained so that it may continue in its role of guarding the revolution and its achievements. The scope of the duties of this corps and its areas of responsibility in relation to the duties and areas of responsibility of the other armed forces are to be determined by law, with emphasis on brotherly cooperation and harmony among them." Furthermore, the preamble assigns an expeditionary role to the IRGC. In the organization and equipping of the country's defense forces, there must be regard for faith and religion as their basis and rules. And so the Islamic Republic's army and the Corps of Revolutionary Guards must be organized in accordance with this aim. They have responsibility not only for the safeguarding of the frontiers, but also for a religious mission, which is holy war along the way of God, and the struggle to extend the supremacy of God's law in the world. Thus, the IRGC has been given a constitutional mandate to spread Islam abroad. Interestingly, Iranian officials, in an effort to broaden the appeal of the revolution, are often at pains to downplay the Shiite nature of the revolution and instead emphasize their ecumenism. For instance, in September 1984, Khamenei stated, "We have no intention of bringing the Sunni brothers to Shiism or the Shia to Sunniism. Rather, the unity of Muslim brothers should evolve around a common axis and common basis. Experience has shown that diversity of beliefs never prevented two brothers from praying together, from launching holy war, from performing the annual pilgrimage to Mecca, Hajj, or from issuing collective declarations on Islamic issues. What is important is unity of purpose and unity of principles, and this exists between the Shia and Sunni brothers in all the Muslim lands. The best axis for the unity of the Islamic community is the Prophet Muhammad. All the Muslim countries should lay aside their petty differences and strive to establish unity among all Muslim societies by creating one popular movement against the oppressors, Mustakbarin." Yet Barr noted that Khomeini and Khamenei after him did not see himself as the leader solely of Iran or of Shiites, but rather regarded the Veliyat-e Faqih as transcending sectarian differences and serving as a leader for the entire Ummah. Notably, Hezbollah regarded the authority of the Veliyat-e Faqih as extending to all Muslims. Naim Qassem, the Deputy Secretary General of Hezbollah, stated, "The jurist theologian's native land has no relation to the scope of his dominion. The same is true of the spiritual authority and the geographical scope of such authority. He could be Iranian or Iraqi, Lebanese or Kuwaiti, or any other. His nationality is thus not related to his qualifications, for he carries the toll of Islam. As guardian of Muslims, Imam Khomeini governed the Islamic State in Iran as a guide, leader, and supervisor of the Islamic system on that territory, but defined the general political commandments for all Muslims anywhere they lived in the context of preservation of the resources of Muslim states, enmity towards hegemony, protection of independence from domination and subjugation, work towards unity, especially on fateful and common issues, confrontation of the cancer implanted forcefully in Palestine as represented by the Israeli entity. His successor, Imam Khamenei, assumes the same role and authorities. Additionally, as alluded to previously, Iran's revolutionaries conceived of the Islamic Republic as a defender of the world's downtrodden, and indeed, in their idealistic enthusiasm, they regarded the welfare of the world as an important concern of the new republic. As noted in Article 154, "The Islamic Republic of Iran has as its ideal human felicity throughout human society, and considers the attainment of independence, freedom, and rule of justice and truth to be the right of all people of the world. Accordingly, while scrupulously refraining from all forms of interference in the internal affairs of other nations, it supports the just struggles of the Mustadafun, oppressed, against the Mustakbirun, oppressors, in every corner of the globe. Despite the pledge of forbearance in Article 154, it is apparent that the Iranian constitution, in requiring the government to spread Islam, foster Islamic universalism, and champion the cause of groups and countries it regards as oppressed, provides the IRGC, and in particular the Quds Force, with wide legal latitude to intervene abroad. From Iran's perspective, the sponsorship of Hezbollah addresses several of these themes, given the historical persecution of and deprivation suffered by the Shia in Lebanon. The 1982 Israeli invasion of southern Lebanon provided Iran with an opportunity to seize the mantle of Islamic resistance against the Jewish state in particular and Zionism in general, and spearhead the liberation of Jerusalem. In turn, Hezbollah's successful resistance against Israel promotes a version of Islamic universalism, with Iran as leader of the Islamic world, to the detriment of Saudi Arabia, which, as guardian of the two holiest sites of Islam in Mecca and Medina, is typically regarded as the natural leader of the Ummah. However, various authors have stressed that there are limits on the degree to which Iran has sought to Islamize its foreign policy. Intishami and Hinnebush noted that by the late 1980s, owing to war fatigue and the death of Khomeini, Iranian foreign policy entered a more pragmatic phase. Additionally, Barr noted a number of cases where Iran set aside Islamism and support for Islamic causes and opted instead to work to establish or maintain good relations with countries that were battling various Islamist movements, including India, despite Kashmir, Armenia, despite Nagorno-Karabakh, China, despite the oppression of the Uyghur Muslims in western China, and Russia, despite Chechnya. Barr also related a candid admission by Rafsanjani, who in 2003 noted that had Iran's constitution been rewritten, it would have been more ambiguous regarding the country's mission to combat the oppression of Muslims everywhere. Such passages would have been rewritten in a more relative and limited fashion, and more emphasis would have been given to maintaining Iran's independence rather than fighting oppression. In view of the element of pragmatism that eventually emerged in Iran's foreign policy, it is important to note that sponsorship of Hezbollah furthered less glorious and more vulgar interests related to raison d'état. It has already been noted that Hezbollah provides Iran with a power projection capability that enables it to carry out a version of extended deterrence, extended meaning farther away from Iran's borders. More specifically, in the 1980s, the sponsorship of Hezbollah allowed Iran to leapfrog the containment imposed by war with Iraq to appeal to a broader constituency in the Middle East, and afterward, as noted by Baiman and Krebs, Iran's relationship with Hezbollah allowed it to more credibly deter Israel. As the authors noted, absent the capability and reach provided by Hezbollah, Iran could not hope to respond militarily to every perceived Israeli transgression, given the relative weakness of Iran's conventional forces and its desire to avoid interstate conflict. Working through Hezbollah allowed Iran to more credibly commit to acting against Israel, because Israel would find it politically difficult to retaliate against Iran for actions undertaken by the movement, even if it is believed that those actions were taken at Iran's behest. Lastly, one could perhaps argue that Iranian sponsorship of Hezbollah and similar groups shortly after the revolution was motivated in part by defensive concerns, and in particular by the need to safeguard regime security. One empirical study noted that states undergoing a revolutionary regime change are almost twice as likely to be involved in war as are states that emerge from a more evolutionary process of political development. And one such motivating factor, as was the case with revolutionary France after the fall of Louis XVI, is the belief that a revolution must be exported in order to protect it at home. Intishami and Hinnebush noted that by 1987, Iran was at odds with many regional countries, and in particular it considered the Gulf monarchies, including Saudi Arabia, un-Islamic, owing to their monarchical form of government, and therefore illegitimate, and puppets of the United States. Additionally, Iran was fearful that these states, in combination with the United States, would seek to reverse the revolution. As Khomeini once noted, "If we remain in an enclosed environment, we shall definitely face defeat." Thus, the sponsorship of Hezbollah and other groups to make the region more Islamic and radical may be seen as motivated, at least in part, by defensive concerns, because revolutionary regimes established with Iran's help may have been friendlier to the Islamic Republic. Of course, as Walt noted, Iranian leaders did not appear to recognize how their own actions and calls for exporting the revolution generated insecurity in neighboring countries. Instead, Iran interpreted regional opposition as evidence of an inherent hostility brought about by internal corruption, dependence on the United States, and the un-Islamic nature of countries in the Gulf and Middle East. Hence, to the extent that Iranian sponsorship of Hezbollah was motivated by defensive concerns related to the safeguarding of the revolution at home, such threat perceptions were likely exaggerated. Resistance movement selection. In the early 1980s, Iran decided it was preferable to establish a new Shiite-based organization to mobilize Lebanon's Shia community rather than rely on Amal, an existing Shia organization established in the mid-1970s by a charismatic theologian, Imam Musa al-Sadr. Al-Sadr, the son of an influential Lebanese Shiite scholar, was born in the Iranian religious city of Qom in 1928 and made his way to Lebanon in the late 1950s. Social scientists argue that the creation of Hezbollah minimized potential principal-agent issues that may have arisen had Iran partnered with a less Islamized organization, such as Amal. But before specifically addressing such issues, as a backdrop, we present a brief history of the formation of Amal and its subsequent split with Hezbollah. The Shia community in Lebanon is widely regarded as originating in the 7th century, when Abu Dar al-Ghafari, a companion of the Prophet Muhammad, was expelled to Jabal Amil in South Lebanon for his sympathy for Ali. Over time, the Shia settled in Jabal Amil, the Bekaa Valley, and Kiswaran, although their villages were subjected to raids by the Mamluks. The Shia were viewed with suspicion by the Mamluks and by the Ottomans, both Sunni rulers. A link with Iran was established during the Safavid era, as the Ottomans viewed Lebanese Shia as potential fifth columnists, and so proceeded to expel many to Persia. Owing to the tradition of quietism, for more than a millennium the Shia largely suffered in silence as they waited patiently for their final redemption with the arrival of the Mahdi. Compared with Lebanon's other sectarian groups, by the 20th century the Shia were at the bottom of all socioeconomic indicators, a reality made visible to them when urbanization made them conscious of their unenviable lot. Additionally, quietism contributed to their political marginalization. The history of Lebanon's Shia community advanced along a new trajectory with the arrival of al-Sadr in the mid-20th century. Before al-Sadr initiated a process of ethnic mobilization, political and economic ideology, and particularly leftist ideology, had formed the basis of Shia mobilization in Lebanon, as disaffected youth coalesced around the Lebanese Communist Party, the Lebanese Ba'ath Party, Nasserite groups, and the Syria Social Nationalist Party. However, al-Sadr's efforts led to the establishment in 1969 of the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council, the first institutional body in Lebanon's history to represent the interests of the country's Shiites. This body was established after widespread Israeli bombing of Palestinian bases in South Lebanon and was intended to be primarily a forum for the emerging Shiite bourgeoisie in Lebanon, whose path to political power was blocked by the traditional Shiite leadership and landowning class, Zuama. Like various contemporaries at the time, al-Sadr rejected quietism in favor of a more dynamic and activist Shiism, and so he sought to establish a mass Shiite movement that would campaign for social justice. He conceived a nonviolent organization, although he taught that martyrdom for the sake of establishing a just society may require a violent revolution. This movement found expression in 1974 with the establishment of the Movement of the Deprived, Harakat al-Mahrumin, and in 1975, this movement established a militia, Amal, Afwaj al-Muqawama al-Lubnaniya, or Battalions of the Lebanese Resistance, which means hope in Arabic, to represent the Shia in Lebanon's looming civil war. Although founded as a militia, Amal would sprout a political organization whose base went beyond the frustrated bourgeoisie that backed the Supreme Islamic Shiite Council to also include the peasantry and poor urban migrants. Through Amal, al-Sadr pressed for protection from Israeli raids in the south, improved living conditions in southern Lebanon, and a greater share of political representation, development expenditures, and government jobs for Lebanon's Shia. As noted by Chahabi, Amal was not a tightly integrated and homogeneous organization. It attracted members from Beirut, the Bekaa Valley, and South Lebanon, with those from South Lebanon being more anti-Palestinian than the former two, and ideologically it counted on both secular and Islamic members. Additionally, in the late 1970s, clerical members of the Lebanese Dawa Party, frustrated by the secretive and underground nature of the organization, joined Amal at the behest of Iran. Many of these Lebanese clerics had established links with their Iranian counterparts while completing their religious training in the holy city of Najaf, in Iraq, and Iran encouraged them to infiltrate Amal to spread a revolutionary Islamic message to a broader audience and to challenge the secular orientation of Amal. Amal was initially trained by the Palestine Liberation Organization, PLO, and by Al-Seka, the Syrian-sponsored Palestinian movement, and it was also a member of the Lebanese National Movement, which was formed by Druze leader Kamal Jumblatt to challenge the ascendancy of the Maronites, although it later turned against the movement and supported Syria's effort to end the civil war. Amal also turned against the PLO, as it blamed the group's cross-border shelling of Israel for the devastation visited on Shia villages by Israeli actions in response to PLO guerrilla activity. The split with the PLO revealed Amal's overall preference for a less hardline Islamist orientation, as it offered evidence that the group, or at least its secular leadership, was willing to at least tolerate Israel's existence as long as the Jewish state left the Shia in peace. Further evidence for the group's relative moderation was provided in 1981 with the election of Nabi Berri as leader. Given his aversion to militant Shiism, Berri led Amal along a secular path, as the group came to represent the interests of middle-class Shia frustrated with the power of the Zawama and other entrenched interests in Lebanon, as well as the interests of southern Shia tired of Israeli reprisals against the PLO. Additionally, Berri did not seek the dismantlement of Lebanon's confessional system, and instead supported relatively modest reforms that sought to include the Shia within a united and secular Lebanon. For instance, Amal supported Syria's 50-50 proposal, made in 1976 for the distribution of legislative seats between Muslims and Christians. It also did not challenge Maronite control of the presidency, and it called for civil service jobs to be awarded on merit. The emergence of Hezbollah from Amal occurred after Israel's 1982 invasion of southern Lebanon, a seminal event in the history of modern militant Shiism. Between 1969 and 1981, Palestinian militants in Lebanon killed 298 Israelis in the northern Galilee, and the Israeli invasion was designed to permanently end the Palestinian presence in Lebanon. Before the invasion, the Islamist elements of Amal were growing unhappy with Berri's rule. In 1981, members such as Hussein al-Musawi, who became the official spokesman of Amal and its deputy leader in 1981, and Syed Subi al-Tafeli criticized Berri for not being supportive of Khomeini and for being insufficiently Islamist, with al-Musawi declaring at the 4th Amal Congress in April 1982 that Amal fighters were ready to retake Jerusalem on Khomeini's orders. The Israeli invasion led to the Islamist break with Amal. Much of the initial resistance was led by leftist groups. And indeed, Amal's leadership in southern Lebanon instructed its fighters not to resist the Israelis, and even to turn over their weapons if ordered. Additionally, Berri agreed to be the Shia representative on the five-member Committee of National Salvation, which was to negotiate with the Israelis and with Philip Habib, President Ronald Reagan's appointee, to mediate the conflict. Berri's participation drew the ire of Iran's ambassador to Lebanon, who called on Berri to resign from the American Committee. Berri subsequently agreed to a peace plan that would involve the removal of PLO fighters from Lebanon, a decision opposed by Islamist members of Amal. this dispute was brought for arbitration to Iran's influential ambassador to Syria, Ali Akbar Motashemi, who ruled in favor of the Islamists. Berry refused to abide by this decision, which prompted al-Musawi to head to the Bekaa Valley and announce the establishment of a new organization, Islamic Amal, as well as proclaim that the Islamic Republic of Iran was the final arbiter on Islamic matters, including determining what was and was not Islamic. Other militant Shias itching for a more forceful and Islamist response to the Israeli invasion also made their way to the Bekaa Valley, including members of student and mosque groups, members of committees in support of the Iranian Revolution, and Shias who had fought with Palestinian organizations. Among such individuals were Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, the current Secretary General of Hezbollah, and Imad Mughniyeh, the terrorist mastermind who would play a prominent role in Hezbollah's relationship with Iran and in the group's attacks abroad. Delegates from each of the various organizations present in the Bekaa Valley formed a 9-member committee to establish a new organization committed to the concept of Veliyat-e Faqih and the struggle against Zionism. This committee sent Sheikh Subi al-Tufayli and Sayyid Abbas al-Musawi, who would become Hezbollah's first and second secretary generals, respectively, to Iran to ask the Iranian leadership to appoint an arbiter for disagreements to ensure that decisions were consistent with Islamic law. Iran's High Defense Council subsequently agreed to the creation of a Council of Lebanon, which, once back in Lebanon, proceeded to build the organizational structure of Hezbollah, and Khomeini also sent a personal representative to the country. At the time of Israel's invasion, the IRGC's Unit for Liberation Movements was hosting a conference on liberation movements from around the world on the birthday of the Hidden Imam, which Iran had declared as World Dispossessed Day. In attendance from Lebanon were Sheikh Shamseddin, Saeed Fadlallah, Raghib Harb, and Subi al-Tufayli, who asked for Iranian help. In July 1982, Iran proceeded to send its defense minister, the IRGC commander, and the commander of the army's ground forces to Syria to inquire how Iran could provide assistance. Earlier in March, Iran had reached an agreement that brought Syria into the Iranian orbit, with Syria receiving cheap Iranian oil while agreeing to close a pipeline carrying oil from Kirkuk in northern Iraq to Tripoli. Given Syria's realignment toward Iran, President Hafez al-Assad could not now turn down the Iranian request to send troops to Lebanon. Shortly after the invasion, Syria, concerned with the Israeli threat, agreed to the establishment of a forward-deployed Iranian headquarters in the border town of Zebdani. Among the initial deployment of Iranian troops were members of the 27th Brigade, named after the Prophet Muhammad himself, and a battalion from the Regular Army's elite 58th Ranger Division, with a combined force sent under the name Forces of Muhammad, the Prophet of God, Kovaye Muhammad Rasul Allah. Some commanders of the 27th had fought against Kurdish rebels in Iran and therefore had experience in guerrilla warfare, and they had also distinguished themselves in conventional combat against Iraq. Motashemi, the Iranian ambassador to Syria, greeted them at the airport, and the Iranian forces were also well received by the Syrian populace, some of whom welcomed them by shouting slogans in Persian. For Khomeini, this initial deployment allowed for the establishment of, quote, a forward strategic position, which makes proximity to Jerusalem possible, close quote. The initial Iranian contingent arrived in Syria on June 11, 1982, 6 days after the start of the Israeli invasion and on the day in which Israel proclaimed a ceasefire. Iranian commanders held meetings with Syrians to determine how best to deploy Iranian troops against Israel, but it became apparent to Iran that the Syrian government was primarily interested in using the Iranians for propaganda purposes. Many personnel in this initial deployment were sent back to Iran to fight against Iraq, but a contingent of 800 Iranian IRGC members did make their way to Baalbek in Lebanon. This figure was reinforced by 700 more IRGC personnel, and most of those deployed were military instructors and fighters, as well as a cultural unit consisting of clerics who engaged in intensive religious indoctrination for Hezbollah and Islamic Amal members. the primary missions of the IRGC in Lebanon at this time and beyond were religious guidance and military training. As noted in 1991 by Hadi Reza Askari, the IRGC commander in Lebanon, the Guard is not a militia. Our mission is to train the people to fight Israel. Over the next 2 years, the IRGC was able to make its presence felt. In September 1983, it assisted Hezbollah in seizing the Sheikh Abdullah Barracks, the Army's main base in the Baalbek area. The base was renamed after Imam Ali, and it served as the headquarters of the IRGC in Lebanon, with Askari sending instructors to provide training in combat and sabotage. The IRGC deployment also led to the Islamization of social mores, as bars stopped serving alcoholic beverages, women began sporting the Iraqi black abaya, the Voice of the Iranian Revolution radio station began broadcasting 8 hours of religious programs and sermons, and pictures of Khomeini and exhortations to seek martyrdom sprouted up on walls. The IRGC mission at this time was also supported by significant Iranian funding that was used to finance various social services that helped build inroads into the local Shia community and facilitate recruiting and indoctrination. Funds were used to assist Hezbollah in establishing religious schools, clinics, and hospitals, as well as to provide cash subsidies to families below the poverty line. Funds were also used to pay recruits $150 to $200 per month, which was far more than they could have earned from other militias. And by July 1984, the IRGC established 6 military centers in the Bekaa Valley for training Hezbollah and Islamic Amal fighters. Furthermore, the IRGC, and by extension Hezbollah, was able to expand into other parts of Lebanon, including Beirut in April 1983, and also into South Lebanon. In addition to serving as a forward operating base against Israel, the IRGC presence in Lebanon served as a testing ground to assess whether the revolution could be exported. Iranian officials were hopeful, envisioning an Islamic version of the domino theory. As noted by the former Iranian ambassador to Lebanon, Hojataslami Fakharouhani, Lebanon is, quote, a platform from which different ideas have been directed to the rest of the Arab world, close quote. And as a result, quote, an Islamic movement in that country will result in Islamic movements throughout the Arab world, close quote. These sentiments were shared by Hezbollah officials at the time, who espoused the transnational mission of the Iranian revolution. For instance, Sheikh Subi al-Tufayli stated, quote, we do not work or think within the borders of Lebanon. This little geometric box, which is one of the legacies of imperialism. Rather, we seek to defend Muslims throughout the world, close quote. On a separate occasion, Hussein al-Musawi noted that the establishment of an Islamic state in Lebanon is not our demand. Rather, the aim was the establishment of an all-encompassing Islamic state that incorporated Lebanon. Additionally, one Hezbollah cleric, a Mahdist, noted that the divine state of justice realized on part of this earth will not remain confined within its geographic borders and is the dawn that will lead to the appearance of the Mahdi, who will create the state of Islam on earth. The first step, however, was the establishment of the ideal Islamic state in Lebanon. In this regard, Iranian officials were of assistance. In fall 1982, Hezbollah clerics, under the auspices of Iran's Office of Liberation Movements, which was controlled by the IRGC, drafted a charter and constitution for the establishment of an Islamic region in Lebanon, modeled on the Iranian system. Additionally, in December 1982, Sheikh al-Tufayli was appointed the President of the Islamic Republic. Yet, as will be discussed later, both Iran and Hezbollah would eventually temper their demands, realizing that neither Syria nor the other confessional groups in Lebanon would permit the establishment of an Islamic regime patterned on the Iranian model within Lebanon. The preceding discussion makes clear why Iran chose to establish Hezbollah rather than work with Amal. Hezbollah's acceptance of Veliat Faqih, its strong antipathy toward Israel, and willingness to use violence to eliminate the Jewish state, and its initial enthusiasm to spread the Iranian revolution minimized what social scientists refer to as agency losses within what are known as principal-agent relationships. These types of relationships entail a situation in which an actor, the principal, delegates a task to another actor, the agent, who is given a conditional grant of authority by the principal to act on its behalf. By delegating, the principal relinquishes some control over the ability to influence outcomes, as some autonomy must be bestowed on agents to act on the behalf of the principal. The risk, of course, is that the actions taken by an agent may diverge from the preferences of the principal, either through incompetence on the part of the agents or, more problematically, because the interests of agents and principals diverge. As noted by Kewitt and McCubbins, agency losses refer to the costs assumed by the principal when agents, motivated by interests not entirely consistent with the desires of the principal, engage in undesired actions on the principal's behalf. Within the current context, Iran can be viewed as a principal that has delegated authority to Hezbollah, the agent, to act on its behalf. The decision to establish Hezbollah rather than work through Amal was therefore more efficient from the standpoint of principal-agent theory, given Hezbollah's acceptance of the doctrine of Veliat-e Faqih and the substantial overlap between Iran's foreign policy goals and those of Hezbollah.